salty ocean, off where the waves roll free. The sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier.
Please note, this episode of Rising Tide contains some material that listeners may find disturbing. Welcome to Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast. This is David Helvarg, and it's great to welcome back Vicki Nichols Goldstein, who's been away.
Well, it's delightful to be here. Thank you.
Today, we're speaking with Kurt Newport, an underwater salvage professional with almost half a century in the field, from operating small manned submersibles to over 150 global operations involving ROVs, remote operated vehicles, or robot subs, plus deep sea technologies of a wide variety. His new book is Ready to Dive, Five Decades of Adventure in the Abyss. Kurt's worked on everything from offshore fiber optic cables to downed aircraft, including Air India Flight 182 that was bombed by terrorists, also the Challenger disaster, and more. But first, blue news you can use. I'll go first, Vicki. The International Tribunal for the Law of the Seas, also known as the Oceans Court, just ruled that greenhouse gases are an ocean pollutant. The world's nations need to take action to, quote, reduce, control, or prevent them. The U.S. isn't one of the 169 signatories to the Law of the Seas, but we also abide by its rules. And although the unanimous ruling by the court's 21 judges can't be enforced, hopefully we'll raise the temperature a little, you know, like the ocean, Vicki.
Well, speaking of ocean temperatures, NOAA came out with some pretty bad news, but it was predictable, saying that there is an 85% chance of an above normal hurricane season this year. With higher than average ocean temperatures in the Atlantic, along with a La Nina forming in the Pacific, they're predicting up to 25 named storms this year versus an average of 14. I think it's time to buckle up for some wild rides.
Right. And then climate may even get into the elections if, I don't know, hurricanes take out Miami, Houston, and boil shrimp in the floodwaters. It's not happening. But what is happening is a conversation with Kurt. You've led an incredible life in marine salvage. But I mean, I started out watching Sea Hunt. How did you start out in your ocean world?
I watched the same show with Lloyd Bridges. Yeah, it was a pretty good program. I started out, I always had an interest in underwater stuff and rockets. I designed submarines when I was 12 or 13 years old. And then one point in time, I didn't have a job and I saw an ad in the Washington Post for a diving systems technician for a company called Ocean Systems based in Chantilly, Virginia. And I started working for them, building ship fenders, then eventually moved over to constructing and maintaining deep saturation diving systems. And then I left Ocean Systems, went to the Commercial Diving Center to learn how to dive as an air mixed gas commercial diver. They got hired back to Ocean Systems, working with their first ROV team, and basically started out in the oil field. Went from there to submarine cable work, submarine communications cable work, and then eventually from there into deep ocean search and recovery.
So backtracking a bit. Sea Hunt, Lloyd Bridges played Mike Nelson, underwater salvage investigator. So you were looking at the technologies, and then you got from fenders into commercial diving, hard hat, helmet diving,
right?
Potentially.
Initially, I worked in the shop. You know, we'd get equipment in from the field. It needed to be refurbished, or sometimes we construct, you know, new diving systems. I mean, I worked on the first 1,500-foot capable commercial diving system. But I wasn't making very much money working in the shop. And I decided, well, I'm going to go start working in operations and go into the field. And that's why I went to diving school out in Wilmington, California, learned how to be a diver. And then instead of doing diving, you know, Ocean Systems was getting their first ROV called Scorpio. And they hired me back to work with that.
Until then, it was all hard hat diving and habitats where you'd be doing saturation dives down to pipelines or rigs. Is that about?
Well, at that time, we're talking like 1977, ROVs were a pretty new technology. There was only a handful of them operating in the oil field. And most of them were basically inspection vehicles, like flying eyeballs. But when I started doing it, there were probably just a handful of remote vehicles working in the oil field, or even in the world for that matter. I mean, there just weren't very many of them around.
I imagine not the fly-by-wire easy touch systems. I mean, these like early cables with motors at the ends of them. And what were the early ROVs you worked on like?
First one I worked with was Scorpio 1. It was a prototype, and it was just basically an aluminum tube frame, which was air-filled. But you didn't have any kind of automatic station keeping. In fact, at that time, we had no ability to track the vehicles underwater. There was no underwater navigation.
So, how did you know where it was going and what it was doing?
Yeah, it was a big problem. when we started out, we would float the umbilical. And this is something we learned from the Canadians. We would put these Norwegian floats on the cable, float the cable out from the side of the ship, and then the last float would have two floats on it, and that would go down in the vehicle. So wherever that last float was, that's roughly where the vehicle was. It really didn't work. We didn't really have the ability to track these vehicles until, I think, 78 was the first acoustic tracking system I used.
So what were you doing with these that a diver couldn't do or couldn't do safely?
Well, with the Scorpio, our first job was in Formosa, in Taiwan. We were trying to harvest pink coral because at that time it was, by weight, it was worth more than gold. And then later on with the Canadian vehicles, we were inspecting pipelines in the Gulf of Mexico. 79, we were inspecting oil production platforms in the Ekofisk field for Phillips Petroleum. So we had a smaller vehicle called the Trek. It's called a tethered remotely operated camera. We would use these vehicles to survey the outside of the oil production platform. We would take CP readings on the anodes so they could judge how much corrosion was on the platform. And then we would fly the vehicle into the platform and actually do a full 100% video survey inside and out. But nobody had ever done that before. We got stuck a lot on the rigs.
So, Kurt, your book, you know, it's this adventure book with all of your experiences, and you have over 4,000 hours of piloting time. So before we get into some of your, like, kind of the crazy things, the adventure piece of it, tell us why you wrote the book and who did you write it for?
You know, I worked on a lot of operations over a 40 to 50 year period, some are fairly high profile, and there have been things that have been written about these operations. But none of these accounts were written by somebody who was there. They're written by a writer, editor, or whatever. So I wanted to write about specific operations from the standpoint of somebody who was actually there, and I could tell really what happened. The other reason was inspirational. I just wanted there to be a written account of what I did.
Well, let's jump into some of your adventures. Tell us about, the Space Shuttle Challenger explosion.
When the space shuttle went down, I was working on a salvage ship called the Stena Workhorse, and our job was to recover wreckage from the right-hand booster, which they suspected of causing the whole thing. The first thing we did was we went out and recovered a piece of the left-hand booster in about 600 feet of water, just to sort of test our recovery procedures. And then after that, we went out to the area where the right-hand booster had been lost, about 1,300 feet of water. And this whole area had been mapped by side-scan sonar. So they had all these targets. One of the big problems was NASA has been launching missiles from Cape Canaveral for a long time. So there's a whole lot of other stuff out there besides Space Shuttle Challenger parts. So they mapped the area, and then other organizations like Harbor Branch Foundation used manned submersibles to go dive on specific sonar targets and identify them as Challenger or not Challenger.
There's that much space junk down there.
Oh, there's tons of stuff. Pershing missiles, Redstone rockets, ships, airplanes, you name it. It's all down there. So then we would go out, and NASA had a hit list. They said, well, we want this part, whatever. And they developed a recovery tool for us to that would fit into the holes in the tanks on the booster wreckage. It didn't work. The tolerances were way too tight. So we actually just made our own. And we had a vehicle called the Gemini, which is a fairly high-powered vehicle that was launched underwater from a top hat assembly. So you would have to wait until the axis of the Gulf Stream shifted east or west to where we could actually do something. So we would go down and pick up pieces of the wreckage, There's a little bit of a complicated procedure to do it. And a lot of it was dictated by the conditions, the environment, especially the current. But the main thing was to find the part of the right-hand booster which showed evidence of the burn-through, which took out the shuttle.
What was the visibility like while you were down there?
Visibility wasn't that bad. We had a lot of trouble with sea life because fish are naturally attracted to lights. In some cases, I would be on a piece of wreckage and there would be so many fish around it that I literally couldn't see well enough to do anything. What I did to kind of get around that problem is I created what was called a fish light. I put a light on the rear of the vehicle. And when we got down to a piece of wreckage, I would turn off all the lights in the front, turn on the one in the rear, wait until all the fish went around to the rear of the vehicle. And then I would turn on the front lights, do, you know, whatever we had to do until the fish figured out there was more light in the front. And it was just a back and forth thing. The fish would go from the front of the vehicle to the back of the vehicle.
That sounds so interesting, but go ahead.
But we did lose the vehicle once. We were working on a piece of Challenger wreckage, and the mechanism that feeds out the cable in our launching system underwater got jammed. So we couldn't, we attached the vehicle to the top hat. So we had to come up separately. And as soon as we got close to the surface, the current was just really ripping through there. And the vehicle drifted downstream, the cable snapped, and the ROV came up and bounced off the bottom of the ship, hit a propeller, and started drifting north in the Gulf Stream.
Now, so how long did it take to recover the booster?
I don't think we recovered all the parts, but I was on that ship for about 2 months. But I think in the end, I mean, I started out in the standard workhorse, then I went on a ship called the Independence with a vehicle called the ASD 620, and that we were operating in much shallower water, picking up parts of the orbiter and the external fuel tank. But I think overall, I'm trying to think, I think we recovered about 30 tons of wreckage from the shuttle.
And recovered, they identified the burn through in the...
Yeah, I actually attached the lift line to the first half of the burn through part. It was really obvious that, you know, these fragments were all broken up, but where the propellant had burned through the booster, it was very obvious. It looked like someone had taken a cutting torch and just melted through the steel. So there was no question about what happened. It really came down to the fact that they decided to launch in very, very cold conditions without any operational baseline of how safe that was. So I mean, NASA really screwed up.
That's the historic judgment for sure. You've been involved in several aircraft crashes, jetliners, both sabotage and accident. What were the most difficult ones you remember in terms of either accessing the site or just conditions and emotional impacts?
Well, Air India was my first big salvage operation. And that is still the worst air disaster at sea. It's 329 passengers. And fortunately, our job there was not to recover passenger remains. It was to recover wreckage to try to figure out what actually brought the airplane down. And it turned out it was a bomb put on board the aircraft by Sikh terrorists. All of the passengers were Canadian citizens, Indian descent.
Now, what was the situation when you got there? It was sort of this unknown air crash in the ocean.
Well, I was on the Canadian Coast Guard ship John Cabot in early June, and we were doing cable work off of Providence, Rhode Island. And when the flight went down, the next thing I knew, we were steaming across the Atlantic. So our job was to go down and recover parts of the wreckage which showed evidence of the bomb. And we started off working from west to the east, doing a line survey, trying to find the first parts of the wreckage that came off the airliner. And then eventually we got into the big debris field. And the biggest part of the airplane I remember seeing was the center section of the fuselage in front of and behind the wings. And it was lying on its right side, with the left wing sticking up through the water column and the right wing folded over on top of the fuselage.
So when you're down there discovering this, how are you feeling? You know, you're in this vehicle, it's deep, it's probably obviously cold, but that's such an intense situation to be at an airplane crash, you know, over 6,000 feet underwater.
The Scarab was kind of an old vehicle. It didn't have all of the automatic controls that newer vehicles have. You know, it was kind of a handful, but, you know, if if you get experience with it, you know, you could do it. You know, I got pretty good at driving it. And I mean, I could take that vehicle and fly it all the way up to the end of the wing, come back in, put it inside the open in the fuselage, look at all the passenger seats all over the place. And
I have to ask, were the passenger seats empty or?
Oh, no, there were people all over the place. I mean, sticking out of wreckage. There was this one area I remember looking in, and to me, it looked almost like medieval. There were just piles and piles of this huge pile of human rib cages, this massive pile of rib cages that had been picked clean by the fish. And there were a lot of people on that airplane. And I think only one body was recovered. They recovered part of the flooring section. It had a bunch of seats in it. And there was one guy they brought up with the flooring wreckage, and he was still strapped in a seat, but he had no head. But that's, you know,
the force of that explosion.
Yeah, I mean, that's typical of an airplane crash. And believe me, it's not the way you want to go. Human body is really fragile in that kind of a situation.
You had mentioned being part of the search for Malaysia Air Flight 370. And I think one of the lessons there is it's still a very large ocean. Do you think there'll ever be a identification recovery of where that went down?
Yeah, I think it's possible if the Malaysian government lets people look for it. There's a company, they've been out looking for it for a while, and they're just doing it gratis. They're saying, well, if we don't find it, you don't owe us anything. But if we do find it, you need to pay us X amount of dollars. For that to happen, the Malaysian government has to agree to pay them if they find the airplane. But they've searched for it for a while, but you know, it probably went down in the southern Indian Ocean. It's not a very well-traveled area. And yeah, I think they have a pretty good idea of the general area where it went down, but general area, that's a big area. But there's not much question in my mind what happened. I mean, this pilot intentionally turned off the transponders on the aircraft, intentionally avoided ground-based radar, and you were talking basically a suicide murder situation. He, for whatever reason, flew the airplane into one of the most desolate parts of the ocean and killed himself and everybody on board.
With your experiences, you know, seeing bodies and, you know, going to these great depths, how do you handle that? And do you have any recommendations for people who might be going into this field?
You know, it's kind of like anything else. You sort of get used to it. Working with a remote vehicle is a whole lot different than physically being underwater and recovering the remains of a human. When we were on TW-800, what my job was, I would fly the vehicle out and we would look for the remains of a passenger. And when we found somebody, we would sit there. And while we sat there, a Navy diver would come down and recover the body, take it back to near the ship, put it into a bag, put it into the diver stage, bring it up to the surface, and they take a knife, cut a hole in the bag, drain out all the water, put another bag on it, and bring it on deck. Now, those are the guys that really had to deal with it, because in that area where we were working this one big pile of wreckage. It was probably, I don't know, 7,500 feet in diameter and maybe 15 or 20 feet off the mud line above the bottom. And it was just this big pile of wreckage filled with wiring, passenger seats, passengers, aircraft wreckage, whatever. The divers, there were so many decomposing bodies in the water. You could see it. You could just see all this particulate matter in the water, which actually made it difficult to see. And this was all from the remains of the passengers. The divers told me they could smell the decomposing bodies through their helmets. So those are the guys who really had a hard time dealing with it. I mean, one of the things I learned is we were on the ship. The first ship I was on was the USS Grasp. And they decided to have this cookout. And so they had this grill up on the bow, and they're firing up this grill and making burgers and hot dogs and stuff like that to give people a break. Well, you know, while we're doing that, we're having this nice little cookout on the bow. There's like about a dozen bodies and bags sitting on the fantail waiting to be taken off by the Suffolk County Police. So it was kind of a weird situation. It was like, all right, got all these dead people on the stern of the ship, and on the bow we're having like a little party, and it was kind of weird.
In some ways, I think in terms of your salvage career, the use of ROVs, that you also saved a lot of divers. I mean, I talked to old commercial divers who were sitting down at 600 feet and, you know, basically doing saturation dives and spending, you know, a week on the bottom in a hut and then another week in a decompression or recompression chamber on the surface. I guess the technologies you work with have really, especially with commercial diving in the U.S. that's not as regulated as Europe. I mean, there are a lot of casualties that divers don't have to take if you have an ROV on the scene, no?
Oh, it's horrible for your human body. You're talking about being at high pressure in sat for a while like that.
Yeah,
it's terrible.
Going deep. Where?
Yeah, you can't do that for very long because you there's, you know, they still don't. I don't even think they still even now understand all the physiology. But you get bone osteonecrosis. Your joints go bad. And plus, there's just the innate hazard of working underwater around heavy equipment and things like that. It's not something you can do for very long. So most divers I've known, they go in there and they do it for maybe 15 years. They make all their money and then they go retire to a ranch somewhere. I mean, if you stay in it long enough, you're probably going to get killed anyway. Physically, it's very hard for the human body to go through all that.
A lot of the technology can do, not all, but many of those jobs in terms of pipeline maintenance, that sort of thing.
I mean, there's always going to be a place for divers. I mean, because remote vehicles cannot do everything. But, you know, when you get beyond a certain depth, there's no way you're sending a person down there anyway. I mean, beyond, I don't know, 1,000 feet or something like that. I'm not even sure if they even do deep saturation diving anymore. But when you get down past a certain depth, you can't send a person down there. The only way you can do that is to put them in a manned submersible. There are those that are operating, but not a lot of them anymore because it's all remote vehicles.
Yeah, we've done some interviews with other pilots, and it really is looking like that technology is improving and there's more opportunities for scientific research, for salvage operations, et cetera. But I do want to slightly change the question I want to ask you next. And you've been underwater, you know, geez, over 4,000 hours, as we mentioned earlier. And I just wanted to know if you've actually seen any kind of environmental change when you are under the ocean, and if you have, what you think might be the driving forces behind those changes?
Yeah, I was waiting for that question. No, to be honest with you, I have not seen any change in the ocean from when I started in 76, 77 to now. The only places where I saw any changes were after a particular event. For example, I don't know if you remember the tsunami. What was it in
2004, December 2004.
Yeah, it was off Sumatra.
Yeah,
we did a job there. We were looking for an Aviate Harrier that had sunk. What I remember about that job, now granted, this is a specific event that happened. We were finding trees like well out to sea that should not be there. There were places of the ocean floor. You know, when we did the side scan sonar search, you could see places where the ocean, the whole bottom had just literally shifted because you could see the ridge lines. They would go up to a certain break and then they would be down and then continue on. So you could definitely tell that something had happened there. And of course, it was the tsunami. It was a massive earthquake. But from the general standpoint, no, I haven't really seen any difference in the ocean. I mean, it's kind of always look the same.
If you're doing salvage at thousands of feet down, it shouldn't look different unless there's a big mining machine down there one day.
Yeah, I mean, look, when you get down into deep water, like say beyond 10,000 feet, it's a very sort of static environment. Temperatures pretty much are constant, 36 degrees. There's no light, very little oxygen in the water, and it just doesn't really change.
Oh, I'm going to switch back. There are tens of thousands of shipwrecks that reflect our history. We now have all the technologies from remote sensing, satellite mapping, side stand scanner, the ROVs you handled are totally new generations today. Are we going to find all that wreckage? I mean, if people want to find human history in the ocean, is that now accessible?
Yeah, it's all accessible, but you got to find somebody who wants to pay for it.
Right. I was going to say, that's a big budget, big ticket item.
I mean, when you get right down to it, if you want to find anything, I mean, let's say there's something that's in the bottom of the ocean, I don't know, an airplane, shipwreck. If you want to find it bad enough and you're willing to pay for it, you can find it. You have to be willing to pay for it. Just, it all costs money. It's like, you know, we have a group now who may have found Amelia Earhart's Lockheed Electra. fact, right. I think I've looked at that side scan image they have, and I think there's a good chance they might have found her airplane, but we'll see for sure. You know, people say, well, you know, why can't you find Amelia Earhart's airplane? Why can't you find this? You know, to go out and do a search in, I don't know, 16,000 feet of water, you're talking $60,000 a day.
Wow, that really is pricey.
Who's going to pay for it?
So what was the most expensive expedition you went on? I think you mentioned the Indianapolis or...
Well, I'm sure Challenger wasn't cheap. I mean, they searched for, over 450 square miles at that time. That was the largest underwater search operation ever done.
Finally, if you're a kid and you're looking for some career in the ocean, why marine salvage?
I don't know if I'd advise anyone to do that kind of work, to be honest with you. I mean, if someone wants to work with that technology, it's better to stay on land and have an engineering degree and develop the technology. But it's just that going to sea, you know, and spending days and weeks out in the ocean and working on a ship, you know, working on a ship is not a really safe environment. It's really hard work. You got to work in all kinds of bad weather conditions. The ships are noisy. The food's not very good. It's something that, yeah, you can do for a while, but I wouldn't do it for as long as I did. I mean, I only did it for as long as I did because I kind of had to, you know, financially, I didn't have any choice. In the last 2 years of when I did this kind of work, you know, when you're always the oldest guy on the ship, well, maybe that's a message like, well, maybe you shouldn't be doing this anymore.
Well, you have had an enormous lifetime experience, and we want to thank you so much, Kurt Newport, author of the ocean adventure book, Ready to Dive, for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast. Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast, is a production of Blue Frontier, co-hosted by Blue Frontier's David Helvard and Vicki Nichols Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, with production support from Holden Hardcastle of Fluid Studios, Natasha Benjamin, and Nick Paz, and editing services provided by Charles Landon of Studio Cape May. You can find Rising Tide at bluefront.org or on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you download your podcast. And don't forget to recommend the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast to your friends and other ocean lovers.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the Blue Frontier. Tear. Off in the salty ocean, off to the Blue Frontier.
Sparky, come here, buddy. Sparky. There you are. Good boy, Sparky.